This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Friday news review starts with some big changes for Covington businesses, including Corporex, which basically built the city's skyline, the River Center Towers, the Ascent. And it's currently building the Ovation Project, which has that big $40 million music venue coming to Newport. So joining us now to start the Friday news review is Cincinnati Business Courier reporter Tom Demiropoulos. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Michael. Appreciate being here.
So glad you could make it today. And so let's start with Corporex. You know, for folks in Northern Kentucky, Corporex is pretty much a household name. That may not be entirely the case on the North Bank. So just give us the basic overview of what Corporex is and why this change at the top in leadership is significant.
Yeah, so Corporex is a commercial real estate development and construction firm. And like you said, they are really responsible for a lot of the development of the Northern Kentucky skyline. But they've also done very large projects here on the Cincinnati side, the Baldwin Center redevelopment years ago and additional office buildings. So they are really one of the top development companies in the area. They own a lot of buildings. They've built and developed a lot by the airport at Circleport. So they are a long time, 50 plus years in the community, long time company.
Yeah, because basically, if you're standing on the Cincinnati Riverbank and you're looking over towards Covington, the whole skyline.
Yeah, they did that one and that one.
Absolutely. And the Ascent, of course, which has become a landmark building, that's a Corporex project as well. And it was founded in 1965 and just until this year was pretty much led by the same guy. Tell us about that.
Yes. So Bill Butler founded Corporex, and he's been the driving force for that company since that time. But now he has found a CEO to take that title from him. Bill will remain on as chairman, so still involved in Corporex, but the day-to-day leadership position is now Dan Sink, who comes to Corporex from the Indianapolis area. And I had the chance to sit down with Dan at their offices, and it was really nice to get to know him a little bit better and see what kind of his vision is for the company. So Dan comes from a very large real estate investment trust, about twice the size of Corporex from the Indianapolis area, Kite Realty. And he was really attracted to Corporex because of its history, because of its success, because of its financial stability. And I even asked him, like, were you even looking for, this type of move? And he said, no, it wasn't until I found out that the job was Corporex that I was like, oh, yeah, I'm interested in seeing what opportunity is there.
And what a time to come to Corporex, because as we mentioned, while they have developed a lot of the landmark buildings in Northern Kentucky, particularly in downtown Covington, they're still busy.
They are. So like you said, we've got Ovation underway with the music venue. The garage is starting there. And then they've got the Madison Place conversion of an office building into luxury apartments, which is moving along quickly. And then they also have a lot of work in the Denver market. So he's working on Denver projects as well. They've got a massive mixed-use development that they're doing out in the Denver area. So Dan kind of hit the ground running in terms of a busy time for Corporex.
I don't think a lot of people know about the Corporex connection to Denver. Bill Butler fell in love with Denver at some point. And in fact, I believe that's where the Fire restaurant concept originated, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. I think Fire at River Center that we know now started out in Denver somewhere.
Wow. Okay.
So yeah, that concept was brought from there. And so, yeah, they're going to be quite busy. They've got a lot of projects going on. And what's this guy's vision for how to oversee all this?
Yeah, so really, Dan, again, comes from kind of the financing side. That's his background. He was a CFO at that REIT, the Real Estate Investment Trust. So he really wants to build a strong, sustainable, financially secure company for the long term. And he's really envisioning what the next 50 years look like for Corporex. So he's looking to add to the team a little bit, continue to develop, and do so from a space of financial strength.
Have you heard of any concern about the company's role in the marketplace? Are they going to lose their competitive advantage without Bill Butler being the face of the company?
I couldn't see that happening as long as Bill's still the chairman. I know that he cares so deeply about Northern Kentucky. That is just, he is so passionate about making sure Northern Kentucky is successful and growing. So I don't see that changing.
Okay, so Bill Butler and Corporex were really the first big heavy hitters to start developing Covington. And now there's been a lot of development happening in Covington and a lot of new businesses popping up. And one such entity is Road ID. And they renovated this old storage building. in downtown Covington, right behind where Braxton Brewery is, to give people an idea of where that might be. And they've grown so quickly that they're already ready to move into another warehouse behind there. Another company's moving in. Tell us what's happening there on 8th Street in Covington.
Yeah, so Covington is really having a moment right now, if you think about it. So Road ID is this company. They make identification bracelets for runners, cyclists, people with medical needs. And they've seen a lot of demand for those as you've seen more people run and cycle. So they were looking to grow. They moved to Covington. I think they were very successful when they moved kind of from the northern Kentucky suburbs into the core of the city, and now they have decided to renovate another building. I guess they had such a good time doing it the first time, they're going to do it again. So they're taking kind of three separate warehouse buildings that are just south of their current facility in Covington, and they're going to move their offices there. Well, what that also does, it allows another suburban Northern Kentucky company, Icon Marketing Communications, to move into their space. So Icon is going to be buying the Road ID building, investing, you know, a couple $1 million into kind of making it what they need for their companies or for their facilities, and they're going to be bringing, I want to say, more than 50 employees is what they expect to have when they move in the next year. So just really good for Covington, a lot of growth.
Is that a trend that we're seeing across the region of some suburban firms looking to find a home somewhere in the center city?
So I have seen that from a number of companies. There's a lot of interest from employers right now of providing a workspace that is attractive to their employees. And that means walkability. That means amenities nearby. That means cool places to go before and after work to get coffee or to get a drink. And I think a lot of employers are following up on that trend because it's such a tight marketplace. You're competing for talent. So you want to make sure you're providing a workspace and a location that is appealing to your employees.
And those companies that are moving, Road ID moving into a new building, Icon Marketing moving in, they are being incentivized by the city of Covington.
Yes, they are. And again, that's what's great about those is they're kind of performance-based incentives. So in addition to the time that they're committing for the incentive period, they're going to stay, I think, 5 years after for both of those. So yes, there's an incentive involved, but they're going to be there for the long run.
All right, let's go out to the suburbs.
Yes.
Liberty Center. What's going on out there?
Yeah, so Liberty Center announced this week that they're bringing in a new property management and leasing and marketing company. It's a company called Bear Properties out of Birmingham, Alabama. And this is a firm that brings kind of more of an owner's perspective with them. The center was most recently marketed and leased by JLL, which is one of the largest commercial real estate firms in the world, but not really an owner of centers. That's not their business. Bear Properties does own and manage properties, and they're really focused on this niche of mixed use, retail, office, residential developments. So this is really right in their sweet spot.
So what are they looking to do that hasn't been done there?
Yeah. So right off the bat, I spoke with their president, Libby Lassiter, and she said, you know, we're still getting our arms around this property in particular, but we can already tell it can support further densification. So not just from existing uses, but adding other uses. One of the things they looked at would be adding office space to kind of the second floor of the Foundry building. That's the enclosed mall type portion of Liberty Center. And second floor retail is really tough. Unless you're a destination retailer, it's hard to get people to make that transition up to the second floor to go shopping. So they're thinking maybe some medical office space, maybe some traditional office space. And that also increases the daytime population of the center. So you're going to have more people walking around, shopping, buying coffee, looking at things. So that's one way they're looking. They're also looking at changing the retail mix a little bit. And they've got a lot of retail leasing horsepower. They're already having conversations with local vendors and national operators about moving in there. And they're thinking more that Liberty Center could use kind of those internet-proof businesses. So things like home furnishings, things like salons and spas, just places that are going to bring people to the center that they can't get online.
Who are the competitors for Liberty Center? Where are they looking to draw from?
Yeah, so that's one of the things about Liberty Center is it's a very large project, and it's kind of right along the I-75 corridor. So, you know, it was intended to be kind of a regional draw, and I think that's one of its challenges is it has to compete with a Kenwood Mall. And right now, Kenwood has a lot of the if there's a retailer that only has one store in Greater Cincinnati, it's typically at Kenwood. So I think that's been a challenge, is they've got to get more of those special, unique experiences that people are going to say, you know, I live in Hamilton County, but I'm going to drive up to Liberty Township because I want to go shop at X. And that's part of the challenge of kind of filling the remaining retail space in that development.
There's a new real estate development firm, and you report that it has big plans for Cincinnati. Who are they and what are those plans?
This is Keen Ventures. So this is a pair of commercial real estate developers who are kind of spinning off from a company called Fortis Group, which is a Fort Wayne, Indiana-based owner of a commercial real estate. And Fortis came into the market a couple of years ago, and they came in very strong. They were involved in a number of mixed-use projects. They're working on The Approach at Blue Ash, which is a more than $50 million mixed-use development in partnership with Al Nayer and Vandercar Holdings. They're working on the redevelopment of the Anthem office site in East Walnut Hills. That's a more than $55 million project that they're working on with their partner, Buckingham. And then you've got the Freeport Row property in Over the Rhine at the corner of Liberty and Elm, which has been a project that's been on the drawing board for a long time. And Keen is working to kind of figure out what the best development is going to be for that site too.
Where do they go beyond that? Any plans for these? Anything that's been unannounced?
Yeah, so this team is really looking at the urban walkable mixed use opportunities, and you know, that's probably one of the hardest things to do because it involves, you know, finding a site, it involves working with existing neighbors. But they've really decided that they're going to spend their time and their effort on these areas because it can kind of move the needle. It can really make a difference when you open one of these projects that changes a neighborhood and hopefully for the better.
All right. Before you run, let's talk about a big real estate transaction that took place in Indian Hill recently. Former Bengals head coach Marvin Lewis.
Yes. So Marvin Lewis has sold his home. I guess this means he will not be coming back to save the Bengals as head coach. No longer part of Cincinnati, was a one of the top we've had a lot of really high-end residential sales this year, but this is definitely toward the top of the market at $2.3 million that Marvin was able to sell his home. So
nice piece of property, it looks like. I'm looking at the pictures, and our listeners can go to the Business Courier website to see the slideshow of the photos. It's really quite nice, but most of those big homes in Indian Hill really are impressive.
Absolutely.
All right. Tom Demeropoulos from the Cincinnati Business Courier, we do appreciate you coming in and chatting with us today.
Thank you, Michael.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Appointments to a city board prompted a debate about diversity at a Cincinnati City Council meeting. And meanwhile, taxpayers have lost $250,000 on an investment in a Westwood market. And then there's this new Mexican restaurant in Hyde Park drawing some criticism over its look. The Friday News Review continues now with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. Sherry, thanks for coming down with us.
Good afternoon.
So what happened at City Hall? There were some appointments planned for an audit committee, and there was some concern about the makeup of that committee.
Well, a hallmark of this current council now has been a lot of concern about making sure the boards that kind of govern all the different city functions are diverse, which is an excellent, you know, it was needed. It came up, of course, because there wasn't any. And so they asked, as part of doing that, for the agenda to reflect, you know, the race and gender of board appointments. And then, right, you know, internal audit committee, not your sexiest board. An important one, though. And you could see it right on the agenda. Items 1 through 5, each of the members, and that's all 5 of the members, they were all white, 4 white men and a white woman. And Tamaya Denard, a councilwoman, was very concerned about that. But when she brought it up, she used the word white-splain. She asked a question about it, and the mayor went to answer with a set of facts about why this was the case. And she was very short with him and asked him not to white-splain things to her. And it was a term that really kind of caught everyone off guard. But it's just, it was the underlying issue that made us write about it, too.
Well, aware that you and I are both a couple of white people as well, what did you find the definition of white-splaining to be?
You know, really just the idea of saying things that we already know about race and gender. But you're right. So we are both white. This has come up on Twitter because I've talked about this a little bit before, and I'm very cognizant of it. But I was the person sitting there and writing it. And the newsroom, of course, we are placing a priority ourselves on having a diverse newsroom. So when we talk about these topics, and I did do that inside of our newsroom before we wrote about that. So I'm glad you pointed that out. But it was kind of a lecture, and it was mentioned in a way that was a lecture to the mayor when he was just trying to answer some questions.
Okay. And typically, I mean, I think the word mansplaining is probably more common at this point, right? That tends to be defined as when
I was like, did she just say mansplain? Like, because, yeah, you know,
that's just when a man is condescending to a woman in some way, as if a woman cannot
exactly.
understand.
Exactly. And
so
this is the same thing when it comes to
racially involved. Okay. So was there any support for Councilwoman Denard's position on that from other members of council?
You know what? Honestly, the word did go by. Nobody really made a big deal of that.
But I guess in terms of the context of the point she was raising,
absolutely,
that there wasn't diversity.
You know, it brought the subject back up. They're asking for this. And, you know, the next agenda that we had with a different board, I forget which one, actually said the makeup of the board. Instead of just being like, this person is, you know, a white male, it said the board is made up of this and these appointments are this, which I think was the intention of what they wanted to begin with. And it kind of gets us down the path. And the other thing is, you know, it really did. She herself, then she put it on Facebook and she was like, can I help find people, you know, to serve on this board and make it more diverse? And she has done that. And so by giving it some attention, then that was extremely helpful to the idea of making the board more diverse.
What was the explanation from the mayor about why it was five white people on the list?
Well, he said it's very hard to find people to serve on that board, which is a true story. I mean, if you look at the people who are on there now, I mean, it's like people from, you know, Kroger Audit. These people are CPAs. They have to. The city has an internal audit committee that does all the work, but this board kind of picks what the audits are, combs through them, makes sure they're on point, and makes recommendations. This is meant to fix things in our city that are broken. And so, and it's not a paid position. So it's a lot of work for a little bit of money, and it's not the kind of board that where there's glory. Now, this isn't a city board, but like people want to be on the library board, and it's easier to find. Some boards are easier to find people for.
You have to work on the audit committee.
Exactly. A lot of work.
And it takes a specialized set of skills. But what does the city do in order to advertise that they have openings coming?
Well, their website was actually terrible on this subject. And you know what? It's kind of sad because that was in 2018 when this all first came up. The intent was to make this easier. And so it had like a couple of boards on their website that you could go on, you could look at them, the sexier boards, it's easier to find people. And here's how you apply. This board, there wasn't a mention of it anywhere. I'm like, how many people are on this board? I was like, I had to take the extra step of asking the city for like public records and information about this board when it really should have been very front and center in the public.
Okay, well, speaking of city funds, there was a market that the city invested taxpayer dollars in Westwood, $260,000 worth of taxpayer dollars. Didn't work out.
Yeah, this story bubbled up from somebody in the neighborhood mentioning this to me. And I really took a look at it. I drove by it on the way home. I live on the west side. And I was like, this is unbelievable. Like, it's supposed to be this amazing, like, fresh food. It was like urban farm, there you take the produce, you sell it in the store, that store makes a corner much nicer and it improves the corner. And this is like a $260,000 project and it fell apart, you know, honestly, within weeks.
Who were the players in this project?
So this is something, it bubbled up from the city administration. It looked like a good project on paper. Doesn't seem like there was a lot of homework done. And a local pastor, Thomas Hargis, and his group, Jubilee, he's the executive director, it's run by a board, really felt like they could put this, kind of pitch this project to the city. And the city said yes in very quick succession, without a lot of vetting.
Okay.
And it failed. It failed. And the city's in the process now. It went through an iteration where it was a corner market that was a drug dealing, horrible hub. The police department shuts it down with a chronic nuisance case. Very expensive. The property is purchased by the city from this owner of the store for $260,000 and then turned over. None of it was ever taken care of. They rack up all these fees and fines. And now the city is trying to buy the property back, you know, with the intent of, you know, you still have to take care of it. You can't just be like, whoops, we failed. This is part of a neighborhood, and you have to fix it no matter what happened.
But that's going to cost more money.
And that's going to cost more money.
Okay, so there's no hope for saving the market, it sounds like.
Not in the iteration that it was. Definitely not.
Okay, you had an interesting headline in your reporting recently. Is Mesa Loca pretty enough for Hyde Park Square. Residents debate the orange and white facade. Okay, take us to Hyde Park Square, Sherry, and tell us what's going on with Mesa Loca.
This bubbled up from one of my favorite things, Next Door Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah.
Not my Next Door Cincinnati, but, you know, somebody I know that's kind of in the group is like, you should look at this. And I really liked this story. So this new restaurant, it's going in where Cock and Bull was, and it's going to be, it's Mexican themed. In fact, it opens tonight. They had a soft opening last week. It's painted white and orange. It is very jarring when you drive by. And there was a gigantic, and it's right, it's it. It's the corner of the square in Hyde Park Square. You know, that is, if anything we love in the city, it's like, you know, our little Hyde Park Square neighborhood. Everyone knows what this is. Very placemaking. And there just was a discussion because some people liked it and some people hated it.
Why was it so polarizing?
I mean, it's jarring. It looks different and, you know, it doesn't break any rules. And like, you know, I think people don't like change.
Yeah,
they just were hilarious, though. Like, I mean, there was like boomer shaming in it. And just,
and we're talking about boomer shaming later in the show. So maybe
I was
I'll
like,
hang on
it was
like,
completely off the rails. And it wasn't a lot of times. Stories will bubble up from Next Door Cincinnati of like, you see a problem and it's like, okay, then you're gonna write about a problem. But this was just a very funny conversation about what we want the square to look like.
You noted in your reporting that Janet, I'm sorry, is it Blenning, a Hyde Park Neighborhood Council
yes.
trustee said that the design does comply with the neighborhood plan and she hasn't heard complaints about it. And then you wrote that social media tells a different story. And one of the comments you included from a woman on social was, quote, it's an unfortunate choice of decor that isn't authentic at all. I guess it would fit in an amusement park. And there is nothing wrong with preserving buildings or squares for that matter, is there? Another person asked, how could this have been allowed? So, I mean, it's just a building on the corner and it's the colors that are too loud, they think.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you could see it just looks different than the rest of the square. And it looks different. And what it was painted black. And so the community council president was like, yeah, when they painted it black 8 years ago, she's like, everyone hated it. She's like, and then it just kind of went by the wayside. Nobody ever said that this fit in and no one really ever noticed.
Well, nothing makes someone need a margarita more than reading comments on Next Door.
It opens
right?
tonight.
They have a new place for that in the very least. Sharon Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer. So glad that you could come in again for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, a local love story as two senior citizens reunite after two decades and hold a commitment ceremony. And later, the divorce is final between the streetcar and Sorta. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. He's 83, she's 73. But it's never too late to affirm your love for someone else. And that's just what this Butler County couple did.
I liked him.
Why?
He's a nice man. Yeah, we went dancing together and go to a movie.
Go to a movie now and then.
Oh, doesn't that just melt the stonest, coldest of hearts? So joining us now with more on that story is Local 12 News reporter Alexa Helwig. Alexa, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I love hearing those sound bites. I like you said, warms the heart.
It really does. So who are they?
Okay, so they both grew up in kind of the Butler County area, and they both are living with developmental disabilities. They actually met 20 years ago at kind of a social event through the Butler County Developmental Disabilities Program, and they recently just reconnected and kind of just fell in love, and they recently moved in with each other. They kind of had to go through a ton of loopholes to kind of make it all happen, but just being, because they are not their own guardians, so they have a guardian who is for both of them, and for so many loopholes, but it's just incredible to see their support team and the people who kind of came together to make this whole commitment ceremony happen. It's so cool to see that they worked so hard to do that. I loved that part of the story.
And so they first met 20 years ago. Did they tell you what the circumstances were there?
Not really. So they just kind of met. They told me they met at a dance. Okay. As you heard in the soundbite, we went dancing. So they obviously love to dance. But yeah, so they met 20 years ago. They both have separate jobs and they don't work in the same place. But recently they met up again at another social event and the rest is history. And they just kind of wanted to seal the deal.
Yeah, so they had a ceremony.
Yes.
Tell us about how that went.
So it was in September. It took a little bit of planning from their support team with the Butler County Developmental Disabilities, that program, their guardian. They got all their family and friends together. They were both dressed to the nines. They both had, she wore a wedding dress, he wore a suit and a tie, and it was just a commitment ceremony. It was beautiful. I don't know if you saw any of the video or the pictures.
Oh, yeah, of course. We watched your story.
Yes. Yeah. So as you can see, it was like a full wedding. It wasn't a legal wedding, but in the sense of they decided to not do it the legal way, but it was a full commitment ceremony. They both wear rings now, and they live together, and the ceremony was just beautiful. You could see their little reception afterwards. There's a picture where they're, like, feeding each other the cake, and kind of it's all over their faces, you know, that... So it was beautiful.
Oh, it's so nice. So what are their circumstances, though? They live together now, but they do have guardians that take care of them. So now are they just all together, or do these guardians just check in on them?
Yeah, so the guardians just check in on them. They do live in kind of an assisted living kind of place. But the guardians just check in on them, and they live together. Ray, he goes out to get the paper every morning for Vicky, brings it in to her, and they sit and read, and they watch TV together. So it's just like they're like a normal couple living together, and it's a beautiful thing.
And so now they just have the one guardian.
They just do have the one guardian, yes.
What did the people who work with Ray Back and Vicky West and sort of the organizations that offer support services, what did they have to say about what this might mean for them?
Yeah, I mean, they just said it's so cool that they were able to reconnect after 20 years. And they have seen, they have done commitment ceremonies in the past for people who work or people within that program, but they've never seen one at this age, this late in life. So, like you said, Ray's 83, Vicky's 73, and just this late in life to see them reconnect and actually do this commitment ceremony, they're just, it's so heartwarming and blessed to know them and to see that this love story. It's like a modern little love story. It's beautiful.
Was there any talk of a honeymoon?
So they did. They did have a honeymoon. Wow. So they went to a Reds game. They spent an afternoon at Great American Ballpark, and they said the Reds won that day, so it was a great day. And then they went on to a B&B riverboat cruise afterwards.
Nice.
So they had dinner, did the whole thing, and they did the honeymoon. So they loved that. There's some cute pictures of them in all of their Reds hats and their T-shirts and stuff. So, yes.
That's really cool. Our best to 83-year-old Ray Back and 73-year-old Vicky West. You can see their story at local12.com. Courtesy of reporter Alexa Helwig, who has been our guest this afternoon. Alexa, thanks so much for coming in. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our thanks to Alexa Helwig for joining us. And now we're joined by WVXU reporter and midday host Ann Thompson with
Hi,
details.
Michael.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
So good.
There's this new massive solar project that's expected to serve the city of Cincinnati, but it's not in the city of Cincinnati. What can you tell us?
That's right. Well, so for a couple of years, the city was on the lookout for a huge piece of property, one that could fit this massive, array of solar panels that would be the largest in the nation. And so that's kind of difficult to find that much land because we're talking about, in Highland County, 1,000 acres or the equivalent of 750 football fields.
Oh, wow.
So even last year, I was walking around with the city folks, and we went to the Center Hill landfill that the city owns, because that was a possibility. They felt like they were going to have to cobble together various properties to get the amount of panels that they needed. This, at the landfill, was only 60 acres. There was some talk that they might use some of the land at Lunkin Airport. But this, where they're going to be having this project, is it's a soybean field. So it's 40 miles east of Cincinnati, and it's going to take a while to build. The city is not putting any money up front. There are a couple of companies that are involved in this, and the city has just promised to buy the energy from it.
So the energy that will be purchased from it, is
correct.
That just to serve the city government, or is it going to be made available to the citizens?
Both. That's correct. You have to live in the city of Cincinnati, and you have to be part of the Cincinnati Electric Aggregation Program. So that's already in existence. And so you can check to see if you are part of it, if you live in the city, or if you're not, you can sign up. Businesses don't have to be in the city. They can become a part of this. So that's kind of the deal, because I live outside of the city, and I was like, hey, can I be part of it? And they're like, no. But even, you know, back in 2015, the city has just been kind of touting its involvement and, you know, its effort to kind of ramp up the solar. They were already then giving residents a $1,500 rebate if they would install solar. And they've had numerous accolades. Like in 2018, Cincinnati was Ohio's top solar city. In 2017, they were the number two in the nation in terms of green jobs. So Mayor Cranley is just building on this, you know, cleaner and greener energy source.
Was there any indication about what a Cincinnati-based customer might save in energy costs?
So I don't have a firm number, but what I can tell you is that they, with this project, will keep the cost of electricity the same for two decades. So in terms of the amount that a homeowner saves, I'm not really sure. But they did say the city is projected to save $1.7 million over the 20 years.
Okay. And what's the timeline?
So the timeline is that the whole thing, I believe, is going to be finished in 2022, but in or maybe it's 2021. I'll have to look back at the dates. But they're going to do it kind of in stages, and there will be a time when here it is. So it talks about a 35-megawatt array to serve the City of Cincinnati facilities should go into service in December of 2020, and then the additional 65-megawatt service to benefit residents has a tentative go-live date of December of 2021.
Ann Thompson always has the scoop on the technology around the region. We appreciate you coming in and telling us about it, Ann.
Thank you so much.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's over between Sorta and the streetcar. So what's next? Here to tell us is WCPO transportation reporter Pat LaFleur. Pat, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
So a lot of the media in town have referred to this as a divorce, and I've been saying it throughout this broadcast. And are we being overdramatic, or is that what this is?
Well, the city would say you're being overdramatic. but, you know, there's a lot of drama around the streetcar inherently, so I'm not surprised that it's being labeled this way. And it is a separation. I think the terminology the city is using is a transition of oversight of the operations of the streetcar from the Transit Authority, which had been doing this on the city's behalf for the last 3 years. Now the city is going to take over those processes.
Okay, so what does that mean?
Well, it kind of just removes a third party from the equation. And based on the way that this all played out, you know, the motions that the Sorta Board voted on this week pretty much undid a lot of the stuff that they had previously done as far as attaching itself to the streetcar. So what really we're hoping to see is the city taking over those responsibilities in a seamless way. Now, that has yet to flesh itself out. And I know that there's still some city technicality actions that have to be taken as well for what's sort of decided on Tuesday to go into full effect. So I don't think it's completely done yet. And we're also still waiting for ballot language for this sales tax increase that's going to be going on the ballot next year. And that's the divorce kind of plays into that process as well. Leaders don't want there to be any sort of association between Cincinnati Metro, the bus system, and the city-owned streetcar.
Why?
Well, you know, there are a lot of answers to that question, I think. Ridership has not reached many people's expectations. There's been a lot of mismanagement. You know, the sort of organization had never run a streetcar system before, so there were a lot of missteps. I think the hope is that the city can just take over and move on.
Yeah, so there's maybe just some idea out there that maybe there's bad brand association with the streetcar, and you're going to ask voters for more money, and you don't want that to weigh you down.
I think that's a huge part of it, yes.
So take us back to the beginning then. Why did the city need Sorta to run the new streetcar?
So the streetcar used a lot of Federal Transit Administration money to build, which means a lot of contracts with the FTA. The city did not have quite the expertise in dealing with that particular federal administration. So they brought on Sorta to kind of be a liaison between the city and the feds. And I think there was just some kind of conceptual pushback against the transit authority not being involved with a transit system. Now, some will parse words about whether it's actually a transit system or something different, but that's all conceptual.
Okay. Well, I did see some news that maybe if people who have not been on the streetcar before, they'll get an opportunity. Was there some free opportunity to ride around on it in the holidays?
Yeah, I know they've done this in the past. They do some weekend days for free to try to encourage new riders to jump on board. That's had mixed success in the past, I would say.
Okay. And before we let you run off, there's a bunch of new staple style bike racks popping up all over town. Who's behind this?
Yeah. So, this same thing happened in Covington earlier this year. About 500 of them are starting to roll into Covington as well. It's an organization out of Northern Kentucky called the DeVue Good Project. They've been very involved in active transportation initiatives, and they just decided what better way to encourage people to ride than provide more free parking for those bikes. So,
and where do they go?
So where they're going is still kind of being laid out. I know that somewhere on the city's website is a page where you can put in a request to have one of these installed near your business or your
That's exactly how it worked in Covington. You could just contact the city and say that you want one and they'd bring it.
Yeah, and I know that Covington isn't even a quarter of the way through installing their 500, so you know it's likely going to take a year or two for all of these to finally find their new homes throughout Cincinnati.
All right. Well, we'll bring you back for an update on the staple bike rack soon, I hope.
Sounds great.
WCPO transportation reporter Pat LaFleur, thanks so much for coming down.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, so why do Ohioans and Kentuckians appear to hate green bean casserole? A new survey suggests that's the state's least favorite Thanksgiving side dish. So there's something that Ohio and Kentucky can agree on, apparently. And we also want to know, is it okay to say, okay, boomer? Let's talk about it. Joining us now are Wine Me, Dine Me writer and WVXU Bits and Bytes contributor Julie Neeson. Welcome back, Julie.
Hello. How are you?
So nice to see you.
Likewise.
And also with us is Cincinnati Inquirer columnist. I'm sorry, my phone keeps telling me about search results of something every time I say our station letters, so I'm going to have to turn that off. The sound is off. I apologize to everyone. Anyway, I was introducing Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Byron McCauley. Byron, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, Michael. Thank you for having us.
Okay, so let's start with Thanksgiving, because this survey came out. The Inquirer published a story about the survey by the Daring Kitchen that apparently, based on search results, discovered that Ohioans and Kentuckians' least favorite side dish is green bean casserole. So we're going to talk about why that might be. So why might that be, Byron? What's wrong with green bean casserole?
Oh my gosh, this is so interesting on so many levels, because Thanksgiving has become, green bean casserole has sort of become Thanksgiving's sort of staple, right? But really, I've never heard anybody at my Thanksgiving table say, this green bean casserole is so good, give me more. Never heard it.
That's a sentence that does not actually ever go together.
That's exactly
I love
right.
green bean casserole.
What? I'm surprised by the hate of the green bean casserole. I like it.
You know, it's less hate, but it's more that it's almost like out of obligation, kind of like the fruitcake of Christmas, right? Green bean casserole. And I know there are lots of different ways to do it. And I was just talking to one of my friends about it. And, you know, she just kind of paused, like, almost like she was horrified to say anything about it, because it's
that
so
bad
horrible.
Out there for this dish.
Well, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I think somebody maybe makes it for my Friendsgiving every year, and there's usually a lot to take home. and it, I mean, like as far as green bean casseroles go, like objectively, it is a good version of it. But like, you know, they're just
this is someone who comes to your Friendsgiving
yes.
regularly and always brings it.
Yeah,
and no one eats it.
Oh no, people eat it. Everybody eats a spoonful.
But it's kind of out of obligation.
That's a courtesy
right?
bite. It's not that's not eating it.
No, I would agree with you. And Lindsay, if you're listening, it is delicious.
Ooh, name dropping.
I know.
Okay.
She knows.
Well, look, we put it out on the WVXU social media channels about what's your least favorite side dish and what's your favorite. So before I get to these comments, Julie, what is the best Thanksgiving side dish?
Oh, man, that's really difficult. I would say dressing personally, depending on what version it is. I was actually talking with Byron about a cornbread dressing like. I do one with cranberries and pine nuts. I am not really big on tradition, which should surprise no one. So this year I'm doing the traditional sides.
Yes.
And lasagna instead of turkey. So if this tells you anything.
All right. There was cranberry in there too. So.
Oh, yeah.
Is that on the good side or the bad side?
For me, cranberry sauce is sort of on the good side, but I will tell you, I have made Susan Stamberg's mother's cranberry, homemade cranberry relish.
Yes, we heard it this morning on NPR.
It is quite delicious.
Is it that good?
Yes.
It sounded good.
Yes.
Okay.
But the jellified canned... not so much.
It's one of those things that you don't really think about outside of the context of Thanksgiving, right?
You really don't, right? And that's another
thing. Unless it's a dried cranberry and you're on
exactly,
a salad bar.
Exactly. And it starts to make you wonder, well, why do we do this every year? Is it torture?
Why
is it self-flagellation?
Thanksgiving at all? Okay, so we asked people about their favorites and their least favorites, and we heard from a lot of our listeners who follow us on Facebook and Twitter. So I thought I would just run some by you guys and hear your reaction, because I was surprised at what some people dislike. So Ann Shepherd Roof told us that the combination of turkey, stuffing, mashed potatoes, and gravy on a too small dinner plate, all seeping into the cranberry relish and sweet potato casserole with brown sugar, roasted pecan topping, whole steamed green beans sauteed in butter with minced garlic. That's her favorite. So basically everything just melted into a
everything
plate
melted.
For one big delicious bite.
Well, that's kind of horrifying for people who don't like their food to touch.
I know, but at some point you got to grow up and get over that, right?
I guess so.
It's very true.
It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
She did say that her least favorite, though, green bean casserole.
Oh, yeah.
So nowhere on that.
She's got the right mind.
Those sauteed green beans sound really good, though.
Yeah.
Like, I'm all about those.
Let me just note that Anne came back to our Facebook thread and replied to her own comment to say, I forgot the rolls and butter crammed on the plate with a slice of warm pumpkin pie with a dollop of real whipped cream. I want to be at Anne's house on Thanksgiving.
Oh, my gosh. Let's go to Anne's house. No doubt about it.
Okay. So Leslie Carr told us that her favorite is oyster dressing.
Yes.
Oh, that is really good.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't like either of those words.
So my father's wife just is an expert at this. They live in the deep south, and oh my gosh,
it's a southern thing.
It's definitely a southern thing. It's more like a Cajun thing. Even
okay,
it's
so good. Is it like its own thing, or is it something that you put on something?
No, it's its own thing. So yes. You know, if you think about like a bread stuffing dressing we may do in Ohio, just add oysters and sausage and like flavor.
Yes.
And yeah, it's really quite delicious. Oh, like the regional dressings are so much fun to look into.
Absolutely delicious. Best dressing I've ever tasted.
Lisa Bowman tells me that she loves roasted Brussels sprouts.
Yes.
I'm a big Brussels sprouts guy as well. That's a good one. Jan Gittinger tells us the least favorite, the dirty dishes, especially the sticky ones. I think we can all pretty much agree with that one.
I think we can agree.
This is why I use paper plates.
Yes.
We use paper plates.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Russell Best tweeted at us that turkey and green bean casserole are the best, but the least are sweet potatoes.
Offensive.
We need to talk about sweet potatoes before we move on to the OK Boomer
sweet
conversation.
Sweet potatoes with candied pecans on top of them.
What about marshmallows?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Sure, whatever. I mean, it's basically your first dessert.
Absolutely.
The sweet potato is the best thing to come out of the ground, whether it's a French fry, whether it's baked with some butter and some brown sugar and all of that.
I had a sweet potato yesterday.
Yeah. I made some soup with a sweet potato.
Oh, it's the best. My favorite dish at Thanksgiving, though, is a can of Pringles, and I'll tell you why. I go to my mother's, for Thanksgiving every year, and I don't buy Pringles because, you know, once you pop, you can't stop.
Right.
And that's so true for me. Like, I'm a total mess. My hand can't fit down in the tube.
I know.
But she always has them there. And so with all the great food that's available, I will sit and eat as many Pringles as I can. You know who else likes Pringles is WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. He always brings exactly 18 Pringles for lunch every day.
Also, he has discipline.
Wow.
One of these days, I'm going to have him on to explain why that is.
I have to ask which flavor, though.
Oh, yes.
For me, it's the reduced fat, not because of the calorie count, because you're eating chips, right? There's no way around it, but I think they're better.
Okay.
This is not a good time to mention Olestra. Okay.
Opening up old local wounds.
Sorry about that.
Wow, yeah.
All right. Maybe boomers will get that reference. It's kind of old. That's called a transition.
Maybe.
So let's talk about this new thing that's going around in comments. People will reply to something that they disagree with, particularly if it comes from a person of a certain age. Okay, boomer.
Mm.
Sort of to blow them off. And I'm wondering, Julie, is this okay?
Well, so I guess I'm the token millennial here.
Are you a millennial?
I am technically. Eliza Schlesinger, comedian, calls us elder millennials.
Elder millennials.
Elder
yes.
millennials. I was born in November of 1980, so oh, wow. I am like right on the cusp. Uh-huh.
I'm born in January of 1980.
Oh, so you're probably an elder millennial too.
I'm either a papaw millennial or a baby Gen Xer. Is what
right.
I'm thinking you all are kind of smarty pants, just a little bit.
Well, what are you?
I missed being a boomer by 6 months.
So you're a cusper too.
I'm a cusper. I'm an older Gen Xer. Like okay. I'm right there.
Yeah.
I'm right there. But
we don't hear
I
a lot
feel
about
more like a boomer.
We don't hear a lot about you know
okay,
Gen
boomer.
X people.
Yeah. See,
they don't have a dog in this fight. It seems. But I'm wondering, what do you think about it, Byron? I mean, is it an okay thing to say to people?
So I remember Talk to the Hand of the 90s. Do you guys remember that? Talk to the Hand.
Yep.
This is to me. This is tantamount to Talk to the Hand,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay, boomer. If somebody does this to me, and they haven't yet, but I've heard people say it. You know, it really doesn't hurt my feelings so much. It just makes me realize that ageism is real.
Ooh. But what about reverse ageism? Because then we spend many years leading up to this point about millennials are destroying the country.
We have killed literally everything.
Glass. We're not buying diamonds anymore. We're not eating carbs.
Fur. You guys destroyed the fur industry.
We destroyed fur. Yep. We probably are going to destroy green bean casserole. I'm just saying.
It's totally the millennials' fault. Well, I mean, isn't turnabout fair play, Brian?
Well, Byron? You know, yes, absolutely. I must tell you, we have not done the millennials any favors. We blame them for everything. And I tell you, you know, we had the millennials.
Mm-hmm.
We birthed them. Well, I didn't birth them, but, you know, they came after. Anyway, I messed that one up pretty good. Sorry, Jill.
But your generation gave birth to that generation,
absolutely.
Certainly.
So we need to take some responsibility for it. So if they're saying, okay, boomer, to me, I'm just going to kind of be quiet and listen to them more. That's probably why.
I think it's also like you don't have to be a boomer to be called okay boomer.
Right.
It's
right.
like it's more of an attitude. It's
right.
the
it's dismissive.
It's the all caps right. commenter on Facebook who's throwing around like propaganda and mistruths or complaining right. about something that they ruined or that, you know, that is out of their control. So
absolutely.
I could okay boomer Michael, if I wanted to. I would never do that. But, you know, it's not, I don't think it's age specific. I think it's more attitude specific.
It's more attitude,
yeah.
isn't it?
Well, so I think we can all agree that Gen Z, the next one that's coming up, they seem to be pretty cool because I'm loving their TikTok videos. I think they're hilarious. They're so creative.
The kids are all right.
They are all right.
So I'm totally showing my boomerness because I don't know what a TikTok video is.
Okay,
I will show you on the way out,
Thank
boomer.
You. Thank you.
It's not like I have the app. I've only seen it on Twitter because I'm a zennial. So I don't have TikTok either. So.
No, they don't let us on.
No, we're too old.
We're way too old.
We're all too old for that. That we can agree
on. Yes, we can for sure.
I feel enlightened. I can't wait for the next intergenerational battle on social media for us to have that conversation. I think it's time Gen X gets into a fight. Let's let them fight with Gen Z for
Gen
a while.
X
it's like the semifinals
down.
Of those of us who are left on this planet. We'll see who makes it to the end.
You guys are too busy rolling your eyes and sighing a lot at the rest of us.
And then I've got a girl. What do you call them? I don't know. But anyway, they're the Gen Z and they... Gusto girls or something? I don't know.
Okay, boomer. I don't know what that is. You can okay boomer me on that one. Byron McCauley from Cincinnati Inquirer, Julie Neeson from Wine Me, Dime Me, and WVXU Bits and Bytes. Thanks so much for both of you coming down and chatting
with us.
Thank
you, Michael.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Find archives online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.